People will talk. Welcome to the latest episode of the Alapra podcast. Joining me in studio again is Maria. Welcome back, Maria, back into the director's chair, and also a very special guest today for interviewing Sarah Stewart, whose credits on the small screen and the big screen and on the stage are pretty remarkable. She has starred in Batman Begins, Transformers, and she's also appeared in things like Midsommar Murders, Taggart, Touch of Frost, and even Doctor Who. Sarah, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
We're both well. Thank you very much as well. And there's so much to kind of jump in and talk to you about, because you've done so many interesting things. But one thing I want to start off with is the fact that you're a dual citizen. If I'm correct, you are. You have a British passport and also an American passport as well. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah, my parents were both American. And they settled in Edinburgh in the 60s and had family and decided to stay, which was so unusual. Sorry, creaky chair. It was so unusual that the sort of national newspaper, The Scotsman, ran a centre's page spread on the fact that this, you know, American family have immigrated to Scotland. You know, it was like, most people were going the other way. So there's a picture of us. I was just a little sort of baby being dangled on my dad's knee as you know, sort of rare as hen's teeth, I think.
And have you ever wondered how growing up in the States, because you grew up in Scotland, of course, but have you ever wondered how... Sorry, Sarah?
No, I was just reiterating what you said. Yes, I grew up in Edinburgh in Scotland.
And have you ever imagined, if you had grown up stateside, have you ever imagined how your career would have panned out if you'd grown up on the other side of the Atlantic?
Well, I have sometimes wondered. It was a bit of a sort of sliding doors moment when I was 17. I flew over to America waving my American passport. And left home and lodged with a drama teacher in Rhode Island and lived there for about 18 months. And in the course of that time, I actually was doing quite well. I auditioned for the Summer Stock. Summer Stock is like a kind of repertory theatre that happens in various locations in New England over the summer. And it was for Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. And it was open auditions. You didn't have to be a student to audition. And I auditioned and they gave me their sort of leading roles for the summer in four different plays. And I got given a Roadie Award for Best Newcomer and all this sort of stuff, you know, and the local college said, if you want to use our drama department without signing up for a degree, you know, please do, and all of that. And the other person who auditioned for the roles that I got that summer was Laura Linney, wow, who I think is amazing. I love her. But I sometimes think, wow, I wonder what would have happened if I'd stayed then. What did happen was that I was encouraged to audition for drama schools in London. And me being a teenager and us not having internet and everything being snail mail and taking 5 days to get across the Atlantic, I only managed to secure one audition. I'm going to cough, sorry. I only managed to secure one audition for a Central School of Speech and Drama, and I got in. And I went back to America and the drama teacher there and everyone else around me said, well, you've got to go, you know, if you got in, that's so hard, it was one in 2000 or something. And And in those days, Central and RADA were the kind of Oxford and Cambridge of drama schools. So I sort of thought, well, I suppose I should go. I suppose that's, you know, where fate is taking me. But I didn't really want to. It's the truth. I didn't want to leave. I was really happy in Rhode Island. And so I do sometimes wonder how life would have panned out if I'd stayed.
That links to a couple of questions. I mean, for starters, it's obvious that you have a great pedigree. If you just look at your IMDb page, you've appeared in a lot of fantastic work. They loved you, obviously. They gave you this award and everything. And just a general question about reviews. And I've seen you've gotten great reviews as well in different things. What's your philosophy? You know, personally, do you like reading reviews, good, bad, or indifferent? Or do you steer well clear of these things?
Well, the problem is you always remember the bad ones. You know, you can get five glowing reviews and then one person slags you off, and that's the one that you remember forever to your dying day. So I try to avoid them. You get a sort of sense if you're in a play, whether it's, you know, if you're in the West End or anywhere, actually, usually they stick them up outside the theatre with the number of stars. Anything good, you know, they'll put it in quotation marks and stick stars up and things. So you can't avoid completely. And I guess if somebody said to me, oh, did you see your glowing review in the, you know, Sunday Telegraph or something, I might, my ego might, you know, take me there. But I try to avoid them. One of the reasons, actually, truthfully, is because I remember researching a play that I was going to be in once. And in order to research it, I read some reviews of previous productions to see what the weaknesses had been and what, you know, if I, because I was about to do it, what to look out for, any pitfalls. And as I read the reviews, they just contradicted each other. Like, one was black, the other was white. You know, one would say, you know, what an appalling production, thank goodness for X who managed to save the night. And then the next one I read would say, you know, shame about X, you know, who brings down an otherwise interesting evening. You know, you think, I couldn't get a sense of it from reading the reviews, which was interesting. I just sort of thought, it's just someone's opinion. And as we know, everyone's taste and opinions differ wildly.
Well, feel free to use a review from this podcast on your next poster if you want. Okay. And speaking of that preparation, you know, I wanted to ask you as well, because you have played the mother of Bruce Wayne in Christopher Nolan's Batman Begins. And this is obviously a creation myth of the Batman character. It's been in so many movies. So approaching this character, was your preparation similar? Did you watch the previous versions of this to see what was maybe cliched, what could have been done differently? What was your attitude towards this character?
I didn't know. I'm ashamed to say that I think the only time I've ever watched it was when I took my son and his classmates to see it for his birthday party when he was 11, which was, you know, I won Cool Mum of the Year award. But I haven't watched it since, and it's not really my go-to genre for entertainment. I'm not really drawn to big action movies and things like that. Although I did love, what was the one that came out? The Joker one.
Oh, was it called? The Joker, yeah. With the guy who's Joaquin Phoenix. Amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, that was amazing. But that was a sort of, that was a different beast, wasn't it? It wasn't trying to be a sort of Marvel comic or whatever. See, I don't even know if it's a Marvel. It's Batman Marvel. It's not.
DC.
DC. I mean, just terrible. Anyway, but that was a kind of dark psychological study of a, you know, I mean, I thought it was superb. I just loved it. Anyway, I did absolutely no research. I figured that Christopher Nolan knew what he was doing if he cast me and he'd tell me what he wanted on the set, which he did. And it was an extraordinary experience. I think almost definitely the highest budget thing I've ever been involved in. And the thing that is of most interest to most people of everything on my CV, and one of the least interesting to me, I have to say. But, you know, I mean, it's quite a small part. Unfortunately, I can't cash in on the circuit of, you know, people pay £10 for a photo and things like that. You know, those conventions that they do, because the part's not really big enough.
I think you were one of the first people to cast, because one of my closest friends from school, he's a big Batman fan. He's listened to this podcast as well. And he was waiting feverishly for news of the new Batman movie. And I think you and the man who played your husband as well in the movie were the first two people to cast in the movie. Is that correct?
Really?
I think so, yeah.
So, well, obviously, you know, when Michael Caine heard I was on board, then, you know, that's why he signed up, obviously.
And Batman as well. for example, well, Marie, if you want to jump in here as well, I'm always conscious of dominating the
thing here. No, I was thinking now that, well, since you mentioned your son, and I was just thinking of the different tastes, like how things change over generations. So do you reckon things have changed a lot in terms of like the actual process of becoming an actor? Do you think, is it the same now as when you started, or how do you think?
I think there's the main difference. Yeah, when you sort of get older actors like me, you know, standing around on set talking about younger actors, it's usually, I think they're slightly intimidating to older actors in many ways, because they really got their act together. It was just such a kind of shambles, really, when I was at college and when I left and when I was auditioning. And, you know, I didn't have a game plan. I didn't really understand how the business worked or anything. I was quite lazy, probably, about learning lines for auditions and all of that. And now everyone's up to their game. I think partly because I think it's an American influence, actually. And partly because also when I first started out, you know, you'd go to a meeting and you'd walk into the room and the director would be there, often the producer, casting director, and you'd chat for a while about all kinds of things. And then you'd chat about the project, and then, you know, they'd ask you to maybe read a bit, and then they might redirect you, and then you might chat a little bit more, and then you'd leave. And it was all quite relaxed and pleasant, actually. Mm-hmm. And now time is money and people aren't messing around, you know, and you go in, and there are a couple of pleasantries, and then they just want to get straight to the scene. You're recorded now on a video camera, which you weren't when I started out, so that they can show the tape of your recording to everyone who has to say yes. And this is another huge difference, was that when I started out, you know, directors had much more authority over who they wanted to work with. You know, if they... Mm-hmm. were impressed by your talent in the room or whatever, and they'd say, no, I really think, you know, that person's the person for this part, then everyone would bow to their artistic taste. Mm-hmm. Now, casting really has to be approved by executive producers, the people with the money. Right. And so the tapes go upstairs, but more often than not, you know, I think the decisions nowadays are driven by commercial interest. You know, who's going to be a draw? Who's going to get us rating figures if it's TV? Who's famous? You know, who's in all that sort of stuff. And they're not, you know, with the best will in the world, sorry, any producers who might be listening to this, but they're not creatives. They're not the creatives. They're actually sort of managers and accountants, and they're making creative decisions. It's quite frustrating for directors, I think, as well. So anyway, young actors have all been primed now in drama school, they've all learned how to do auditions, and they all know you've got to absolutely, you know your lines, and they've all practiced with cameras and all the rest of it. So they're super prepared, and sometimes they turn up on set with great kind of volumes of books with notes that they've made and this and that and all the work they've put into it. It puts us to shame, really. I mean, I think we used to just laugh and we'd all go and get pissed afterwards, and you know, genuinely, that was, you know, a lot of actors were alcoholics. That a lot of it was about just sort of being wild and crazy. And now it's like a profession, a proper profession.
I suppose linked to that.
So you think it's removed a bit of the romantic element to it?
I don't know. I mean, maybe. I don't know. I mean, there's a generational difference anyway, not just with actors in that sense. I think that, you know, my kids are 26 and 28 now. But when I don't know, it seems to me, I remember going out dancing once with somebody I don't know, 15 years ago or something. So I would have been 40. But we looked around and everyone seemed really quite reserved on the dance floor. And we were, of course, you know, probably the embarrassing older couple at the point. But I remember he said to me, you know, the youth don't know how to have fun anymore. And I think there might be an element of that. There's a sort of worthiness that seems to have belonged to the younger generation that maybe we were a bit more wild.
That's interesting.
I think following on from that, maybe a criticism that you would hear sometimes of the modern acting career is that maybe it's more exclusive than it was, that maybe it's only accessible now to maybe people who come from a certain background, for example. I could ask you if that's a valid criticism, or maybe if you think that's true and it was different in the past. How would you react to a question, you know, to that kind of perception that exists in some places?
Well, I do think, actually, you know, it's a shame. It's a weird one to unpick, that one, because, of course, what happened in the 1950s and 60s was that working class kids would go from, you know, famously the Welsh mining villages, and they'd go to somewhere like Rada, and they'd come out sounding like aristocracy, and that's how they would proceed to talk for the rest of their career. So while you can say that, you know, working class kids were given the chance, they obviously still felt they needed to sound posh in order to get on. So, and I think now that people embrace more sort of authenticity, so being who you really are rather than being an actor and speaking like this, you know, that people like accents and they like diversity and all the rest of it. And I do feel, I mean, my experience of casting anyway is that everyone's really hot on diversity at the moment, on making sure that there are, that everyone is represented, whatever your background is. So I don't know how true that is. I think it always does feel exclusive when you're on the outside. Mm-hmm. I think it just seems impossible to break in. And then somehow, miraculously, you do. And then you're working, and then, you know, there are other people looking at you and you're on the inner circle. But it's, I don't think there's any guaranteed, you know, I mean, I think, for example, I think if you're a white, you know, I think if you're a white middle / upper class English actor, mm-hmm. under 30 at the moment, that you're very unfashionable is what I would say.
We're big on diversity on this podcast as well. That's why we have a male and female host. directed in modern times.
Spanish and Irish.
International base there. I just want to ask you just one more question before we veer off into another area. You mentioned earlier about maybe younger actors are worthier. They kind of take it so seriously. And for example, I can't remember the name of the actress, but she's in A Quiet Place. She's an English actress, Emily Blunt. And she did this very intense scene where she's in a bath giving birth and these aliens come in and she can't make a noise because the whole idea is that it's based on noise. If they hear you, they kill you. And it's a very well acted scene. And as soon as the director, her husband, said cut, she was like, okay, so what's for lunch, basically. And my question is, are you the type of actor? Because I've seen you before as well. You know, you introduce a piece. We'll talk about that later as well. And you slip into an American accent, for example. Are you the type of actor that can just like slip into the mindset, the accent, the world of a character in an instant, and you don't have to be in that mental space for maybe 30 minutes before the cameras start rolling?
Definitely not 30 minutes before the camera starts. Oh my God. it depends how demanding it is the truth. You know, an awful lot of the stuff I've done on camera is really not demanding that much of me. You know, it's sort of stand there. Hair and makeup does a lot of my performance for me, you know. And I think there's also something to do with, you know, you end up getting, I mean, funnily enough, you know, when I was at drama school, I was actually sort of seen as an incredibly versatile character actressy type actress. I could slip into lots of different accents and roles and ages and everything. And that's sort of what I thought my strength was. And then you get out into the profession and they don't want to use you like that, you know, and suddenly I'm just getting cast as quite a lot of sort of ice queeny type, you know, powerful women, which means you're not very expressive. I love an opportunity to be expressive, but I get it on stage, but not very often on camera, which is a shame. So I definitely don't have to go and sit in a quiet corner for 30 minutes to go and look impassive. But I suppose what happens is you get into a scene, and if it's a big, heavy, intense scene, which, you know, I have done the odd one, they rehearse it for cameras, for all the rest of it, before you actually film it. And so there's a more than half an hour usually before the camera actually turns over, mm-hmm. for you to really get into it. And actually to get into it in situ with the other actors, within the space that you're going to be doing it and all the rest of it. So, you know, actually on stage would be more where you could literally walk out of your dressing room and just boom, you're on stage and you're somebody else. The cameras don't turn over that quickly. Although Michael Winterbottom, who I just realized I did four films of his, Michael Winterbottom, did Guantanamo, Geneva, Face of an Angel and Cock and Bull Story. And he works, you don't know when the camera's turning over. So it's all improvisational. So he kind of comes over and he's very like, yeah, so I just want you to be like talking about this and you to be doing that. And maybe it pisses you off at some point, you know, and then he sort of wanders away and you just start doing it. And he's sort of hanging around and you don't know when the camera's on and when the camera's off. There are no lines. And I love working that way. And I guess, you know, I don't know, he used me four times. So I guess, you know, it worked. So that's very different. What's quite dull is when you get your kind of, you know, meat and two veg TV drama, where they do very predictable one wide, two shot, tight shot onto the next scene. And I can remember once actually, because I naturally quite kind of expressive and I use my hands a lot, which you're not going to see now because it's a podcast.
we can confirm it's happening, but
nobody else will know. There was a director once who, and it was one of those kind of, you know, standard TV productions. and they were shooting me from the sort of shoulders up or something. And I think and he came up to me and he said, "You need to stop moving your hands so much." He said, "Sit on your hands and all of that energy that's going into your hands, just channel it into your eyes." I thought, right. And I, in some ways, that was great direction, actually, because it's very technical, you know, with a camera. It's not just about free expression and they sort of catch it, unless you're a Michael Winterbottom. It's usually very technical and they want to be able to match shots and they don't want you doing anything distracting, you know. So it's very contained a lot of the time.
And do you remember any specific direction from one of the directors you've worked with? Because you mentioned Michael Winterbottom. You've obviously acted as well in movies with people like Steve Coogan on a couple of occasions, if I'm not mistaken. Is there anything that was very instructive for you? You know, you heard something from them and it really registered and resonated and really helped your craft as well.
No. I can't think that I've ever been on set and heard somebody say something that changed my craft. Honestly, I don't think I have.
Well, that does.
You know, I mean, I think that it's wonderful. You know, I've been lucky enough to work with Judi Dench three times, I think. And somebody like, she is really, really extraordinary to act with. Mm-hmm. Because you believe it. A lot of the time you're acting with other people and you are aware of the fact that you're both acting. And with her, you forget. She just, you completely get drawn into her world. She sort of weaves this whole world around her that you become part of. And she's very, you know, down to earth and jokey between takes, and you know, she's not standing in the corner beating her brow trying to get into character or anything, you know, because she's profound, you know, she's experienced, she's learned her lines, she's studied the character at home, she's come in to do her job, you know. Yeah. And I do think a lot of the job is creating a good atmosphere. I'm going to say something now, which might be controversial if there's anyone American listening, but my experience of working with Americans or on big American sets is that they don't have the sense of camaraderie that British actors have. And I think it's because we've grown up in the tradition of theatre, and we're lowly actors. You know, we all band together and piss about and get drunk and do, you know, all of that. And I think a lot of people in this country are drawn to acting for that sense of family and kind of belonging that you get when you're in a theatre company. And my experience, limited, I grant you, but still, of big American actors and big American sets, is that it's a bit humorless and it's a bit, takes itself very seriously, and that there's not much connection. You know, it's a sort of weirdly kind of competitive environment, which isn't much fun to be. So actually, there we go, you know, that fork in the road. It's just as well I went to Central and I didn't stay in America.
So you think it's easier to form like strong bonds with, you know, when you're working in the UK, for example, than when you're working in America?
Yeah, I've not really worked in America, to be fair. I've done American productions. I mean, some of Philomena was filmed in America, but that was a British production. I've worked on American productions in other countries like South Africa or London or, you know, wherever. I do think, I could count on one hand the number of actors, British actors that I've met that are difficult, hardly any. So generally speaking, you know, I mean, part of the job also requires you to sort of form an instant connection so that you trust each other so that you can act together. you know, you can't be sort of busy being self-conscious and shy with each other when you, when you've got to let your hair down in front of the camera. So, but actors, generally speaking, in my experience, are pretty easy animals to get on with. You know, they're a lot of them are pleasers by nature. And they're enthusiastic, excitable, so it's sense of fun and play and all the rest of it.
Well, you mentioned Julie Dench, and obviously she's such a famous actress and a big reference for a lot of people. So I don't know if it was a little bit, well, you mentioned she was very nice and it's probably not that intimidating, but one of the films that you did with her was Philomena. And in this case, I think this woman actually is from the same town as Enda. So it's and obviously it's a big story, well, just for Irish people, but also for internationally. So what's it like for you to, you know, tell a story like this? Is a very powerful story. Obviously, real life is very dramatic, and you know, it still touches the life of a lot of people, and it's quite difficult to deal with for a lot of people still. So,
yeah,
how do you approach something?
Oh, it's very powerful, and I actually met the real Philomena as well.
Really?
And, yeah, she came to the screening. She was lovely, and in fact, I was doing a reading at a carol concert or something for a breast cancer charity, because I had breast cancer 10 years ago. And so they wheel me out from time to time to talk about that. And a man came up to me at the end and said, you were in Philomena. And I said, yes, I was. And he said, well, we're from the same town. And we know Philomena, and our daughter died of breast cancer, and she was an artist, and I've got a few postcards with these paintings she's done of Irish mountains, and I have a very few, but I want you to have one. And he pulled this postcard out of this painting, and he gave it to me at this recital, and I've got it framed in my hall. That just meant so much to me, because that also is you don't often really experience the effect that something you've been in has on people. That felt deeply personal to me. But then I also did a show called Quirk. I don't know if you ever saw that. That was, we filmed that in Dublin, and it had a superb cast, and Gabriel Byrne was the lead in it, based on a series of novels. But the storyline was looking at the same thing, looking at babies that were taken from their mothers and put up for adoption and sold. Quite a lot of them sold to American movie stars and people like that. And in the production room, the director told me that, you know, because it was a largely Irish crew, and somebody said, well, I was adopted. And someone else said, I was adopted too. And he looked around the room and he said, how many people here were adopted? And about half the people put their hand up. You know, they were older, obviously, because they were key crew and all the rest of it. And that, he said, that was when he suddenly thought, oh my God, we are handling a very hot potato here. You know, this really does touch people's lives in a big way.
That's incredible. Yeah. How do you find, does it have an influence on you when you're acting, if it's like such a personal story and there's so much behind it? Because, for example, you've been in all the stories that also had women at their center, but for example, Mrs. Brown, where it's Queen Victoria, so it's got a completely different character. It's not really something that people can relate to in a personal level, but perhaps about the story of friendship, and that's the most relatable thing that they can do. So does it actually help you
I think the thing is that I'm not sure it does help your performance to think about the bigger themes of the piece while you're acting. I think that that's the director's job, really, to bring all of those strands together. And so I think the main thing is exactly what you said, to make any person a relatable human being, is to find the commonality and the human parts. You know, I mean, if I'm playing someone who's unlikable, I have to try and find something likable about that person, you know, because otherwise it's just boring. It's just two-dimensional. We all have good and bad in us. And so why is she behaving like that? Why is she like that? And is there a moment where I can slip in a flash of vulnerability or something like that, so that it's not just two-dimensional? And those are the things that I love rooting around in the sort of psychology of a character, and trying to find, a sort of common humanity.
Speaking of characters and also theatre, because of course you've done a lot of work on the boards as well, you mentioned that the character you played in The Cherry Orchard was a character that was on your acting bucket list. Are there any other characters that are on this list as well that you've managed to play as well in different stories?
Well, the big one for me was Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, playing Martha. That is the second time I've played in Martha. That was the play I've been waiting to be old enough to play that part, you know, since I read the play when I was 26 or something. And I got the opportunity to do it, and that was amazing. Other parts that I'm longing to do, it's a tricky one. I don't know, I'd quite like to play Our Cardinal and the Seagull. I'd quite like to play, I'd quite like to play Amanda in Private Lives. I think that would be fun. Ghosts would be another one I'd like to do. There was that moment where I suddenly thought, oh my God, I'm never going to play Hedda. You know, I'm too old for Hedda. And I'd always thought one day I would play Hedda, and I never did. So that was my Hamlet moment, you know, classically male actors suddenly go, oh God, I'll never play Hamlet. You know? Although look at Ian McKellen playing Hamlet, and he's nearly 80 or maybe even 80. So anything's possible these days. People like mixing it up, especially the classics.
And we just have a couple of other things just to ask you before we start finishing up and, you know, letting you enjoy your evening. We both enjoyed your monologue for Rapture Theatre, which is online.
I can't believe you saw that. How on earth did you see that?
We do our research on this podcast. was this for coronavirus because of the pandemic? And was this a way of putting art online, or
idea. No, it was the guy who directed me in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, who owns a theatre company called Rapture Theatre Company, and very, very sadly died about 3 weeks ago, which was completely unexpected. He was only 50, and he had cancer. That's a shocker, because we were in conversations about plays that we might want to collaborate on again together and all the rest of it as well. And I just always assumed that we would. So that's a real shame. But in lockdown, it was his idea to sort of keep things bubbling. And he asked a different actor every week, you know, if they could do a monologue. So that was the one I came up with. I mean, it's very poorly lit and filmed in my bedroom. I mean, it's before I'd mastered the art of self-taping, which we all had to master in lockdown, you see, because now all auditions are self-tapes. So now I've worked out where the good light is in my room, and I've got a little tripod, and I can do, you know. But that was me literally sort of peering into a light and holding a camera. It's terrible.
I know, it's fantastic. As I said, we both really enjoyed it. And the last question I have to ask you before we finish today is, you've, of course, as I mentioned at the start of the show, you've been in Doctor Who, Touch of Frost, Taggart, Drop the Dead Donkey, Midsummer Murders. The answer to this question has to be yes. But are you a British institution?
The answer to that has to be no. Absolutely, I'm not. But I'm really flattered that you think I might be. I wish. Sadly not. There are plenty of actors out there. I'm just one of them.
You've been a fantastic guest on this podcast. It's been really lovely chatting to you. Thank you so much again for taking the time out of your schedule to do that with us. And we're both big fans, as we mentioned, of your monologue, but also just the stuff you're done in general is really, really great. So it's been a real pleasure for both of us to have you today.
Oh, that's very kind of you. And if you live in Spain, don't you? There's a thing there I filmed with Alejandro Amenábar called La Fortuna, which will be coming out probably around September, I would imagine. But
Brilliant.
I think they'll make a noise about that, because
I'm sure they will.
Yeah.
That's great.
That's an interesting story, isn't it? Because as far as I know, that's the Americans found some Spanish treasure and are trying to claim it, and the Spanish government were trying to get it back. That's the plot.
That is exactly right. It's a true story. And it was Stanley Tucci's in it, who I'm a massive fan of. So that was exciting. I think it's going to be a 6-part miniseries, and I play another powerful, implacable woman, the judge.
We look for your eyes expressing the hand movements.
It's all through coming through the eyes, and just know that I was not standing in the corner getting into character.
Well, we'll definitely be tuning in. Best of luck with that. That sounds fantastic as well. Another great show. Thank you from me. And of course, Marie, I'm sure you want to say.
Thank you. Thank you so much. That's lovely.
An absolute pleasure speaking to you both.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you for having me. Bye.